Okay, so I sent out on my email, I never usually do this, a topic. The email was, we'll attempt to connect. Megillah Esther, I hope you all brought a Megillah. Parshat Tzav, matzah balls, NPR, and bacon. Did you know? I don't know if you know that. Nobody knows what NPR is? Ah, okay. For all, I mean, this is an international shiur for all of you listening. You know what NPR is? NPR, NPR is National Public Radio. National Public Radio is a, what's it called? What is it? It's a liberal, but it doesn't matter. I'm not interested for that reason. It's a news gathering organization in America. Okay, which is, you know, like a national news gathering organization in America. Kind of like a network, but a little more liberal. So there was a story, which I'll be happy to send to you, on NPR. It's one of these culture stories. They do culture stories. That says the following. Matzah ball meets bacon at Top Chef restaurant.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
well,
sorry.
Yes, so I wanted to share this with you. At his restaurant in downtown Los Angeles, Top Chef Ilan Hall, is wrapping a piece of bacon around a traditional matzo ball. Meaning, like, he says, why does he do it? Okay, he says, the pork fat makes it incredibly fluffy. Yeah, right. Okay, so he's both Scottish and Jewish. He says the following. My mother's from Israel. My father's from Scotland, both Jewish. When you want to make your best food, you need to go back to your roots. So, of course, what could be more Jewish than a matzo ball? And of course, if you want, and bacon. So I saw this, and I'm gonna. He said he didn't grow up eating bacon wrapped matzo balls, but haggis, schmaltz, and kishka were often on the table. Haggis. What is that? What is haggis? I don't know what that is. Sheep brain. All right, it could be kosher. Anyway, you know, and like basically, how should we say? He serves pork belly hash, gefilte fish and chips, and pork belly braised in manischewitz. You know, like me do. Yeah, manischewitz.
Big red wine.
Manischewitz is like no religious Jews don't really use it anymore, but like traditional Jews buy it for Kiddush because that's what you have
for the Seder,
right? But, meaning like this struck me because like what is a Jewish food anymore? You don't know what's a Jewish food anymore? Jewish food, of course, is matzo balls and but like of course we need a new twist on it nowadays. So we need to twist it with bacon. And I bring this just to not just to outrage you, you know. And he, like, sadly, if you listen, the stories NPR is really a media. It's not a website. It's a news organization and it's a radio station. So if you listen to the actual report, he says that his grandfather. It's fascinating. He says his grandfather was a kosher butcher in Israel. Wait, don't say oi yet, because he says his grandfather was a kosher butcher in Israel. He was unable back then, when his grandfather was a butcher in Israel, you couldn't get pork products in Israel. So his grandfather used to smuggle in, now you can't apparently, used to smuggle in his own pork products through Lebanon for his personal consumption. You know what I'm saying? Because he just liked the way the pork tasted. You know, like, so, lo aleinu, like parents, like children. And this all, I bring this up, again, not just to outrage you, but to raise an issue that I'm going to hopefully tie to Megillat Esther. How is this connected to Megillat Esther? This idea that what is Judaism to so many people, I think to the vast majority of people, nobody listening to this year, but the majority of Jews, right, they would find it, on the one hand, scandalous to have a matzo ball with bacon, but also interesting. Like that's a new twist on the Jewish food. And they wouldn't necessarily find it problematic, necessarily. At least the bacon part they wouldn't, because they all have bacon. You know, and you know, if you'd ask the majority of Jews, we are the minority. We are the small minority who would say, like, okay, that sounds crazy, but who would say, this is terrible. Not terrible. You know what I'm saying? It's like, whatever.
And yeah, I was going to say, the paint's been comfortable. In South Africa, it's not like this. Yeah,
it wouldn't be like that. It would be terrible? It would be terrible. They don't eat non-kosher food, the Jews? But they won't eat pork. So it's really funny. He goes, at the end of the thing, he goes, yeah, you might want to try this. He says, but just don't try it on Pesach. And I'm like, what's wrong with trying it on Pesach? I'm like, the problem with pork is not on Pesach. Right, it's because of the Pesach. That's not the problem. But, so it's interesting that you say that in America, for sure, this idea of what Judaism means is very much matzah balls and not at all not pork. You know what I'm saying? To a large, you would agree with that?
Yeah.
You know.
I know this this girl who had made a seder, and they didn't have bread, but they had pig.
Had pig.
Pig at the seder.
Yeah. Yeah, and whatever. Like that's not contradictory. Okay.
What she was serving.
Uh huh. So I wanted to start, we're going to start with Parshat Tzav, even though we're going to do, I said we're going to do the Megillah, but we're going to start with Parshat Tzav because of the issues of the day that are surrounding us, I think, you know. In Israel, at least, for those people in Israel, and I've heard, actually, in Chutz La'aretz it's much less, but in Israel we are still overwhelmed by the tragic news of what happened last Friday night. You know, and how pervasive it is, and if you go out in the Israeli public, even more so, and it's a topic of conversation. I work in a school, and the teachers were talking about it with their college of education, with their students. And the instructor, he's an instructor in counseling, and he was actually going to teach his students about how to counsel their students, their future students, and they just wanted to talk about it. You know, and how do we react, and how we relate. And I'll just say that one thing that they said is important. In this country, it was a little bit surprising to us how open schools are and kids with their kids. In Ghana, they came home with it.
I asked Lizzie what she heard about it, and she just the teacher just told them about the three children that survived.
Right. Oh, really?
Which I thought was really well done.
Interesting. So, but in school, they are.
Our Ghana did it from the angle that she's going to the Levaya, that she's performing a mitzvah.
Right. Yeah, it was just interesting to that, and they in Israel, it's very much about the need to talk about it because the kids are going to hear about it, they're going to know about it. But they have to talk about it. See, they talk about it. Yeah, you know, and it's frightening. It's frightening. It's traumatic, and it's important to talk about. Anyway, so that being the case. I heard this week, I saw this week the name of Tzvi Yehuda Kuk. Rav Tzvi Yehuda also used to say that Parshat HaShavua is a Parsha of HaShavua. Meaning it's not coincidental that whatever Parsha that we read, there's something in the Parsha that relates to what's going on in this week's, in the Shavua. So, what? Yeah, so interesting. So I'll just read you the beginning of the interesting, and I'll share with you an Or HaChaim that I'm sharing this week, which is unbelievably frightening and also powerful. The beginning of the parasha starts this way. Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. Tzav et Aharon v'et banav lemor. Command Aharon and his sons saying, Zot Torah ha'olah. This is the Torah of the olah. Hi ha'olah al mokda al ha'mizbeah kol ha'layla. It's the olah on the, it's moked. It's place, it's location. What a translation do you have on that? This is the olah. This is the law of the olah.
Yeah, mikud, placement.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the law of the elevation of
the elevation. Okay, it's moked. It's, I don't know. Moked? Focus? Moked is like a... Right, it's like, it's point, it's place. Okay. Alam mizbeach kol ha'layla, arabokir ve'esh ha'mizbeach kikabon. The light and the fire of the mizbeach will be lit in it. V'lavash ha'kohen midoban. And the kohen... Well, is that mine? No, that's not ours. Somebody in there. The Kohen will just turn it around or something, okay? The Kohen will wear its bad. Umichazei bad yobasha b'sarim ve'rimit hadeshen asher tochal la'ishet olah mizbeach. This is called trumat hadeshen, and you should pick up the deshen on the olah v'samo etz al mizbeach. So, and then we'll just skip to pasuk hey. V'ha'esh al mizbeach tukadbo lo tichve, and the light on the mizbeach should be lit in it. It should not go out. Ubi'er halea kohen etzim baboker baboker, and the kohen will burn on it wood all every morning. Ve'arach alea kohula, and he shall place on it the ola. Ve'tir alea chabei hashlamim, the fats of the shlamim shall be offered on it. Esh tamid tukad al mizbeach lo tikve lo tikve. You've heard of this esh tamid, the ner tamid, right? The continual fire should be on the mizbeach; it should not be extinguished. Okay, so this is the idea that there's the Kohanim, there was a specific mitzvah, the Ramban points out, there was a mitzvah for the Kohanim to leave, to make sure that the fire on the Mizbeach never went out. That it was continually burning. And there was the idea that they always had to be removing the ashes from the Mizbeach. So there's a long essay in the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, right? You can see the Or HaChaim, it's a very long essay in the Or HaChaim, For those of you who have it, we're not going to read it inside. I'll just read you a portion of it. Noach Chaim, his name was Rabbi Chaim Ibn Attar, Moshe Ben Attar. Rabbi Chaim Moshe Ben Attar was born in Algiers. He spent the vast majority of his life in Algiers. He was a Rav in Morocco. And then, at the end of his life, he made Aliyah to Tzfat. Okay? And he lived in the 15th century, 16th century, the 1500s, the 16th century. And he writes the following. So he writes about the idea of the Esh and the Zbeach and the Ola. And he says this idea, he says the idea of the Korbanot and the Korban, there's a lot of Rimazim in it. A lot of hints and a lot of allusions in the Ramazim. Okay? And he says the idea of the Ola, okay, explains the following. One second. Yodia HaKatuv. The Torah will say, you have to find out, I can show you if you want to look it inside. Ki bo'or boker te'eshan af Hashem. In the light of boker, in the light of the morning, the anger of God, te'eshan, it will burn forth. From the word ashan. From the word of ashan or ashes. Ve'esh mipiv tochal et asher inyano inen invano b'nei ola. Right? Those who are b'nei ola. Who are the b'nei ola? Those who are burnt offerings. His children. V'yisrunu, and he will afflict us. B'yisurei nekama. Okay? Yisurim, afflictions of nekama, of vengeance. U'bifrat b'nei ha-ma'arav ha-pnimi. Specifically those who are ma'arav ha-pnimi, the inner west. Not the far west. The inner west. Who did he think the b'nei ma'arav ha-pnimi are? We'll see in a second. Himself. Okay? En l'cha kos mar shelo hit'imo tamid. There is no bitter cup that we did not always taste. V'hu omro esh ha-mizbeach. And this is what he says, the fire of the Mizbeach, Sheramaznu bo b'chinat ha-yisurim me'omot. Right, this is the b'china of the yisurim, the afflictions from the nations. V'lo richem libam la'asher hika Hashem ze yamim v'yishpil ga'on Yaakov. He says, this esh tamid, the fire of the Mizbeach, what is the ola on the Mizbeach, the burning embers of the ola? We are the ola that suffers on the altar of the yisurim. Of this continuing, of this consuming fire. Hold on. He goes on. He also says, there's also an additional allusion. He says, V'hen galut, okay, mit Yishma'ilim. This is also the galut of the Yishma'ilim. Ashrei mi lo ra'a mishabdim umerarim chaye Yisrael. Fortunate who he who did not see them who is subjugating and embittering the lives of Israel. V'lo dai lo yidnu schar. It's not enough they don't pay us for the things they make us do. They continually ask more and more of us. They demand more and more. It's bad enough that they steal what you have. They want what you don't have. And they say it's not enough they demand from the Jews X. They want X plus Y. And they make us drink this bitter cup until we die. Okay. El Meirim Roshi, you should raise up Meirim Roshi et hadeshen asher tochal ha'esh. This is the ashes consumed by the fire. Esh ha'amim, the fire of the nations. Okay. V'tzeu leman me'ish levush habadim et ha'ola shei uma hanikret ola. Right? What is the Ola? We are the nation that is Nikret Ola. And then you read this Perush of the Or HaChaim on this week the language in the newspapers is the Tevach. Right? The word Tevach is Shechita. Right? The Shechita Ta'ola Tamima. And there's no other way to say it. Right? The offering to Hashem. And we say it in mourning and we cry and we mourn and we need to talk about it. But this perush, it's still true. It's still there. Even though, Baruch Hashem, we're in our land and we have strength, nonetheless, the persecution persists. And the Ola Tamima still continues to suffer. And these words I'm sorry if I don't have any more words to comfort you, but these words of the parsha, it continues to resonate. And we have to acknowledge it and understand and accept the Yisurin and hope that mitatam shel tzadikim is a kapara for us all. Okay. On that note, we'll move to Megillat Esther, but I had to, you know, and we're going to throw it in also at the end, yeah.
The ashes also remind me of an interview that I heard yesterday with a nuclear scientist from Catholic University talking about how they can't cool the ashes from the nuclear plant that exploded in Japan.
Yeah, it's really bad. They say they don't know what to do with it.
Permeate in the atmosphere there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More ashes and fire.
Yeah. On that note, thank you for that uplift. No, I started. Okay. So today I said we were going to do Megillat Esther, and I'm going to tie it to the matzo ball soup, matzo ball bacon soup, and see how it's connected. If you all open your Megillah, we're gonna focus on a number of different things. These are, did I do Megillah last year? I never did Megillah in this group, didn't I? So there are basic concepts. Well, see, everybody needs to talk about it. Yeah. Yeah, I remember also, like, each time there was a chant, like, I remember when I was in YU one year, there was a terrible massacre, like a bombing, of some terrible bombing right before Purim.
When I was here in 96.
Yeah, 96, it was like that, it was about then. It was terrible.
We just arrived and we couldn't go anywhere, like, we were on a year away,
and
it was stuck,
because
just bombings
were
pretty much every day.
So yeah, and it was around this time, it's like, Bar Goldstein was right before. Yeah? When you're here for the year, Okay. So if you will open your Megillah, so I'm going to deal with a number of fundamental midrashim, fundamental ideas that are central to the Megillah. I haven't talked about it in this context, and there are midrashim that are really important for us to know, for us to be aware of, and to understand that in the Megillah, one of the most important things to understand about the Megillat Esther is most of the action goes on between the lines. Most of the action is behind the scenes. Okay, there's a lot of information that the Megillah is hiding, is covering, that the Chachamim fill in the blanks for us. And it's really important to understand that in the Megillah specifically, the text is also an allusion to subtext. And the reason we know this is because it's a later text. It's not like, you know, Malachim or, you know, Lahavdil even. Like, you know, of course the text of the Torah carries great weight and so many different meanings. But it was written intentionally as a satire, it was written as a parody, and it was also written not to explicitly say the things that it meant to say. And that's very important to understand. That when Mordechai wrote the Megillah, he wrote it in such a way that it would have at least two, many more meanings. And that's the brilliance of the Megillah. That it's on the surface, it's a farcical story, it's a tragedy. What?
Lahavdil, it's almost like a Shakespeare, you know, comedy tragedy where you're like,
correct. Lahavdil, but that's exactly the point.
So why did he do this?
Why did he do it? Because he was writing it explicitly and sending it out at a time as an official document. But in the official document, it was really, who's the document for? Meaning he wrote it and he sent it to all the countries and all the nations. Right? He was an official in the court of Ahasuerus at the time. So he wrote it in Hebrew, and Ahasuerus, I'm sure, I said, what's the book? What's the story? And it was for everyone, correct? And so on the one hand, it's a tragedy and a triumph of the Jewish people. But on the other hand, there are critical, critical messages in it for the Jewish people that are hidden. Okay? And so we have to ask ourselves fundamentally, and I will say, this is my religious Zionist take on Megillat Esther. It's unabashed, I've given it before, and I think that there's undeniable truth to it. And it is also important, how should we say, geopolitical and historical relevance of Megillat Esther to us today, and relevance to us even in our day and in our time. And it will relate to the matzo balls, and also us here in Yad Binyamin as we speak now. Okay? So, you came late, you don't know what I'm talking about, the matzo balls, but...
I saw something with NPR.
Right. So I'll show you later, if it's a little late, okay? The first question we have to ask is, you always have to ask, and I think people forget to ask this fundamental question, why did it happen? I mean, why did the Jewish people, when things of that sort come up, you always have to ask the question, why did Am Yisrael deserve to be destroyed? Meaning, if this great threat happened, and without this miraculous salvation of Esther, and, you know, the hidden hand of God, and the Hester Panim, what did the Jews do? And that's a critical theological question that the Gemara actually asks. So we'll start with the Megillah, and we'll address it from the... Actually, it's a Gemara and a Midrash at the very beginning of the Megillah. Okay? So it starts in Vayibin Melech Hashverosh. We'll just leave in the beginning. We're not going to read the whole thing, obviously, but we'll start at the very beginning. Okay, I will say, I just saw recently, these midrashim are critical. It's very important. This is not an easier version. This is the Torah Shleima of Rav Menachem Kasher. He wrote a whole set called Torah Shleima. He wrote it like it was his life's work. Rav Menachem Kasher, I don't know if he survived the Holocaust, but lived in Manhattan, actually. And he died, you know, not so long ago in Manhattan. He wrote a whole book called Torah Shleima, very thick works. It's a comprehensive work. It's unbelievable. Remember that midrash that I showed you, the blue set that I showed you with the midrashim that you bought? There's also a green one now of all of Navi and Megillot. So that's the next thing to get. Navi and Megillot, the midrashim on Navi and Megillot, which I don't actually have. Want to mention that if anybody's listening. Okay. Next birthday. Okay. So in the context, it's a book about Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh Hamolech Mehudu Ve'Arkush Sheva Ve'Esrim U'Meya Medina, 127 Medinot, right? Which is, at the time, 127 Medinot, the entire known world. Okay? Known world. Except for? Greece. Okay, it's important. Right. If you can study. He didn't conquer Greece. He tried. If you want to study this in another context, there's a whole other context you can study in. There's a historical context you can study in. What is this party of Achashverosh? And we're not going to do that today. 127 countries. Right? Where is Shushan? Nobody really knows. Who made up Shushan Abira? Shushan has one claim to fame. It is the head of Achashverosh's kingdom, which we'll never hear from it again. Meaning after Shushan falls, you'll never hear from it again. Vishnat Shalosh Malka Asamishtel Chosar Abadav Chel Paras Umadai HaParti Mesemet and Lifonav. Who is the party for? His ministers and? What?
Servants.
No.
His officials, the army.
Ooh, the army, right. So it's interesting. This, you just, if you notice carefully, it's a party for his army. Right? When you bring in all your army, you make a party for them, what are you planning?
War.
Correct. So just know, okay, whatever. Just understand that. Harato is Osher, Kavod Malchuto, Bet Yikar Tiveret Yulato, Yarmim Rabim Shorim, Uma'at Yom. 180 days they had this party. Okay, what do you have 180 days? Even Achashverosh, in his most debaucherousness, in his debaucherosity, nobody can party for that long. What did they do for 180 days?
Plan
something. We don't know what. I mean, it's not, you know why we don't know what? Because it's not important to the story. But if you want to figure it out, you probably could. Okay, Uvim lo'ot hayamim ha'ela. When he finished, Asa ha'melech l'chol ha'am nishudan ha'birah migadol v'akitam nishteh shivat yamim. He made a 7-day party. Why would you make a 7-day party at the end of your 180-day party? Something good happened at the end of the 180-day party. So you want to celebrate something that happened at the end of the 7-day party. Okay? Fine. I mean, obviously, you need, in order to finish a party, you need to have another party. Okay. But who did he invite to the second party? It does. It says who invited.
Everyone.
He invited everyone. Okay? It's interesting, you'll just notice the Megillah goes out of its way to tell you ridiculous things that you could care less about. Do I need to know the fabrics that the king's designer chose in order to decorate the party? You know what I mean? Like,
but we cited silver rods and marble fillings.
What? Really?
No,
you know, like. Ah, wait. Very good. Okay. What flooring did the designer bring in for the hallway and the party? I remember, like, when I was in the rabbinate in Oak Park, so I remember once there was a bar mitzvah that cost $200,000. A certain family, not in the Orthodox community, spent $200,000 on a bar mitzvah. And the theme was, I think it was going to the movies. Every plate had under it like a movie reel. That was the thing under the plate. What is it? No, not a chart. It was a reel. You know, like when they used to have the old movie things. Oh, the charger was a reel. It was a real movie reel they had brought in. And the reason why I was involved in this bar mitzvah was because the proprietor, the Balabait, insisted that they have real wine from France, not Yayin Neset, not cooked wine. It had to be Yayin She'enu Mevushel. So we had to have special hashkacha to make sure that only Shomer Shabbos people were pouring the wine. Whatever. And so the reason I remember this is because they brought in tents. They constructed tents outside the shul on which they brought in leather couches for people to lounge on while they were drinking there. What?
I went to a
wedding. Like that. Yeah, okay.
Built a whole building for the wedding.
Right. Right. Yeah. So this is like, really? Really? Okay.
That was $1 million.
Apparently Mariah Carey sang at that in Libya. Yeah.
So we went to they donated the Sefer Torah and they flew in bands from all over the world.
Yeah. Anyway, obviously the idea, what was the king's idea, his goal, we can all tell our war stories about parties that we're in, okay? Okay, that he's showing his opulence and his wealth. Vashkot, b'chlei zahav. Okay, now anybody know how you read this now in the Megillah? I have to read it to you, right? You have to read it for you. I'm gonna lane for you. This is important to understand. The laning. Right, it's the laning of Eicha. I'm gonna read from Vav. Orcha pas udechei, let achutz b'chavim uzvar gaman, anglilei kesen, avudei sheish. You can hear in the laning of Esther. No, that's not mourning. That's fun. It's like, you know what I'm saying? It's like a playfulness of the trap. The trap is beautiful in that way, in that it really takes on. So now read in Zion. Vashkot b'chlei zahav. Why is it sad? What's the mournful? It's immediately in Echatra.
Yeah.
Okay? Why do we do that? That's Mesora. What's the Mesora? Why do we do Echatra? What are the Chelim Shonim? Now tell me what are the Chelim Shonim? Correct. That's the Mesora. The Mesora is that they were drinking the Chelim Shonim. You know what I'm saying? Blah, blah, blah. Who was invited to the party? Who went to the party? Everyone.
From small to big.
Every person lived in Shushan HaBira, from small to big, including the Jews.
Would you say that the wine was kosher?
So some say that it was kosher. In Pshat, it means nobody was forced to drink. Everybody could drink whatever they wanted. Meaning, open bar. That's what it means. Good. Good. So is there such a thing as... I will even say, I personally do not believe that's true. I don't think that that's true. I think, what?
You don't believe
that it was Mahadran kosher. Meaning, if we all try to extrapolate to our day and age, in a sense, in order to understand what was going on at the time. But, what?
It was lots of bagels and matzo balls.
Lots of bagels and matzo balls, what? Not kosher, right? That was that. That's where I'm going, obviously, right? You know what I'm saying? What?
Sorry.
No, that's good. Obviously, I'm like leading you in a certain direction, which is exactly where I want to go. That the idea being, let's say it was kosher. No, let's say it's even worse. Let's say it's glatt kosher. What was the party about when he invited the Jews? V'chelim mikelim shonim. What was the idea of using? Meaning what? But what's the point of using the kelim for the Beit HaMikdash? This is exactly Chazal talk about this. What was the point of this party in the eyes of Chazal? Why did he say more powerful than
Hashem?
Why? Because they had known about the Midrash says they had known about the exile and the prophecy of the 70 years. It's a very, very famous important point that they knew that it was the 70 years. After 70 years, the Jewish people were supposed to return to the land of Israel. And thank you. Don't worry. I'm okay.
Sorry.
Okay. And before him, I think it was Daryavish. He was the king of Babel, right? Daryavish, remember the handwriting on the wall, and the savior of Daniel, and he thought that he had conquered this is a period of Jewish history that's not well known enough. I think we have to review it because it's so relevant. He had thought that he was done, that the Jewish people were not going to return, and he had overcome the Jewish nation. Also, Nebuchadnezzar Melch Babel, and he constructed this whole thing. We'll talk about that in a second. Right, the idea being that the Jewish people were done, and therefore that there was a new game in town, new kingdom. The Jewish kingdom is over, and this new kingdom is now the new man on the scene. And now Achashverosh comes along and says, ah, we figured it out, the 70 years are over, and therefore, say Chazal, he trumpeted out, he pulled out these kelim, kelim shonim, to show this is over. New world order. What's the new world order? Who's included in the new world order? No, it was everybody. This is the... No, but Lav Davka, I mean, I don't think Achashverosh necessarily, at this point, there is no, like, we are the new way of thinking. Meaning, this idea of Pchel Paras and Madai, 127 countries, the world is united under the banner of unity and prosperity for all, especially me, right? And I don't really care where you're from, I just want to know, are you in the 127 countries or not? Am ba'am, medina, medina kirshona, va'am ba'am kirshono. You understand the point? This idea that it's very, how shall we say this, almost in a sense like progressive.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? We're not going to try to influence or force our way.
It reminds me of sort of pre-Nazi Germany when you had the Jews were the top scientists and everybody was sort of long, you know, in business, and then all of a sudden there's a change. Like, this comfort level doesn't last.
I mean, I'm not going to say, I wasn't going to, I always wonder how apocalyptic I can get without really turning people off. You know what I'm saying? I mean, in this crowd, I think I'm preaching to the choir, so it's all good. You know what I mean?
It's wasn't that Alexander's, like, why we honor him so much, was that he was so successful in taking over.
Who?
Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
The
Greek model. What was the Roman model?
Oh, she's right.
The Roman model was.
The Roman model was hundreds of years after the.
The Greek model was also.
The original Greek model was that everybody do their own religion.
That's right. That's right. And when did the Greeks have trouble with the Jews? The reason they really had trouble with the Jews was because the religious Jews rebelled against the idea of. This idea of Greekness, of you know, assimilation.
If you're open to all religions, then one of the things the Greek government wanted them to do was that in your temple, you also need to have a statue of our king, because we are supporting
yours.
All religions.
Right, I think that was less troublesome. It was more troublesome. The real rebellion happened when the Jews came along and said, right, you know what I'm saying? The Hanukkah story, I mean, this isn't our holiday, but the Hanukkah story was really mostly Jews against Jews. It was mostly about the Hellenization of Judaism, the Mikyavnim, and the destruction of the Jewish people. You know what I'm saying? The willingness of Jews to go along, which is just, history just repeats itself. Says the Gemara in Megillah, a Gemara that you have all heard of, but we're going to repeat. Sha'alu Talmidav et Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Mibnei man nitchayibu son'em shal Yisrael ba'oto ador klaya. So anytime the Gemara uses the term son'em shal Yisrael, the enemies of the Jews, but it's a euphemism. The Gemara never wants to say explicitly, why were the Jews obligated to be destroyed? So it says, why were the enemies of the Jews? But it really means the Jews. Why would the Jews merit destruction? Amar lahem emru atem. He says, you guys tell me. Don't ask me. You tell me. Amru lo, this is Gemara Megillah, you'd bet Amud Aleph. Amru lo, b'vnei nahanu misudam shel ta'ota rasha. It's because they ate at the su'uda of that rasha. They went to the party. Amar lahem, so he says, one second, imkein, shebeshushan yaregu, b'chol ha'olam kulo yaregu. Why? Fine, that's the Jews of Shushan. Why are all the Jews in the world? Amr lo, amor ata. So they said, okay, Rabbi, now explain. Now you tell us. Amr lem, b'mnei shehashtachavu latzelem b'mei menuchem Nebuchadnezzar. Because they bowed down to the idol in the times of Nebuchadnezzar. They worshipped the tzelem. Who were the only three Jews that did not bow down? You know the story of Hanan Yimshal Be'azariah? You know the whole story of Hanan Yimshal Be'azariah, the Kibshan Ha'esh? Wow, it's really worthwhile to learn Daniel. Maybe one of these years somebody should learn Daniel. Then the problem with Daniel, what's the big problem with the Sefer Daniel?
It's all in
Aramaic. It's all in Aramaic, right. It's all in Aramaic. Which makes it challenging to learn. Yeah, it makes it a little troublesome. Okay.
Like when people used to, when Jewish people were invited to the White House, I think when George Bush was the president, if he wanted to make a push, he made everybody.
But he wasn't a Russia.
No, right, he did. There were parties, yeah, where they brought in Kush. I know the guy who was the Rabbi Mashir. In the White House, they would go in. They might actually the whole thing.
He wasn't a Russia. That's a big difference.
According to Chazal, so why are they obligated with klaya, with destruction, for participating in that seuda? Why? Because according to Chazal, the subtext of the meal was their own downfall, was their own destruction, was the end of the Jewish people as we know it. I mean, there is no more chosen nation. Enough of this chosenness. Everybody is under the banner of the kingdom of Persia and Media. Right, enough of this. We, you know, they're saying we are celebrating a new world order. Who comes to this celebration and eats? We'll say, you want to say it that way? Eats glatt kosher? No, no, no. The Jewish people come. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like, it's like, imagine if, like, I don't know, like the
there's that Hanukkah prayer event in the White House.
That's not, I don't equate that. Because that's celebrating the uniqueness of the Jewish heritage. I don't think that's a fair equation. Okay. You know what I'm saying? I mean, imagine, it'd be hard to say. I can't even think of an equal thing, but like, you know, nowadays it's hard to think of an equal. Yeah, right, exactly. Imagine the president of Iran invited the Jews to a glatt kosher, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not entirely sure it was glatt kosher anyway. You know what I'm saying? In another version of the Midrash answers, Amru lo, they said to him, why are we obligated? V'halu kol Yisrael arevin ilein ve'ilein. Kol Yisrael arevin zeh bazeh. There are, you know, why? The Jews of Shushan are representative of what's going on. They're representative of the pervasive feeling. So let's you ask another question. How could the Jews go? How could the Jews go to that party if they were invited?
How could they not?
How could they go if they were invited? Meaning, if they knew the subtext of the party.
Well, maybe someone
let's assume that they did.
Yeah.
How could
they not
trouble
go?
They
didn't want to draw suspicion to themselves. They didn't want to...
Well, maybe you also.
What do you mean? The king is not overtly anti-Semitic. He's not against them. He's inviting them specifically and telling them we are.
They want to keep him sweet.
Maybe
well,
they
recognize him and be dafka and not the Jeff.
What?
He's got you so much trouble.
They went to the party. They partook of the party. They enjoyed the party. How could they go?
Because maybe he was. They felt that he wasn't being overtly anti-Semitic. It was just that one.
He's not being overtly anti-Semitic.
Yes, the only thing he doesn't like is the whole thing about Jewish sovereignty and about their returning to Israel.
Correct.
He feels
just that.
Just right. That. That's the only thing. Everything else is fine.
Is there such a thing?
They want to keep it.
If let's assume that that's the subtext. Meaning, of course, you know, there are different understandings, but let's assume that that's
like
the subtext.
If a queen
so maybe they tell what's such a big thing that one invites someone.
She rabbi to the which she has to the wedding of her grandson. He's not going to say no and snub her.
The chief rabbi is invited to what?
The wedding
of
Prince William.
And what if he married a Jew? And would that be so far-fetched today?
No.
Right.
No.
And what would the chief rabbi then do?
Don't
chief rabbi, in honor of we cherish and honor the fact that that we are so excited that royalty is finally married Jewish. You're joking, but this happened in America. This happened in America. I mean, when Chelsea Clinton married a Jew, for many, many Jews, this was the arrival of the Jewish people. And for me, the harbinger of real bad things, to be honest with you. This was, the Clintons are American royalty. They really are. They are the top shibbit top of how high you can get in America. You know, former first lady, the secretary. I'm not joking. I'm not exaggerating.
First black president in terms of that he loved the blacks.
Right, but right.
He was
So can you imagine the chief rabbi? Chief rabbi, we are honored to invite you and would like you to offer a benediction at the celebration of the inclusion of the Jewish people, finally among the monarchy and the family of royalty. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine what would he say?
He would not sleep for
weeks. How would he finesse this one?
Yeah, no, they want him to be an aide.
Yeah, right. Chief Rabbi, you representing all Judah, in you know, how would he finesse this one?
Well, did
it happen? What? Of course he wouldn't go, but it's a massive chil Hashem.
Get sick at the last minute.
What? No, but he can't get sick at the last minute. He has to say I can't go. He has to say I can't go. He has to say to the queen that for all your openness and for all your willingness to be inclusive, right, I can't accept you. He has to say that. Get us in trouble.
There's something in between a rock and a hard place.
What?
Was it so obvious to the Jews that Hashverosh's party as that? That's pretty obvious. Like, that's
well, the Gemara says, yes, it was. Yeah, we're going to get to that too. Hold on. We'll get to that too. Can you imagine? By the way, it's so far-fetched to imagine. It's like that by the grace of God, that model wasn't Jewish. You know what I'm saying? That he didn't want to marry a Jew because he wouldn't have cared. This is the world in which we live today. You know, and I never thought of that scenario. Thank you for that. That's like
dressing up as a Nazi.
You know, like, okay, so I mean, whatever. But he didn't dress up as a Nazi maliciously. He didn't think about it. He didn't think about it. It wasn't significant. But it wasn't significant to him. Hold on. But the idea that they celebrate, that they went to that party, says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that, and I wonder, was it glad kosher, was it not glad kosher? It was irrelevant, because they themselves were then acknowledging, and this I think is the problem, they were then acknowledging, we have arrived. This is our arrival. What is the Jewish idea? How could they go? And the answer is, did they think about it? Did they not think about it? Either way, it's equally bad. Why is it equally bad? Because if they thought about it, if they thought about it and went, when they, what they themselves were saying was, we arrived. And if they didn't think about it and they went, they were even, it's even like almost worse, that subconsciously they say, wow, the king invited us to this party. This is our new place. This is our new time. Right? Here's what I believe. And I think this is we think of the people in Shushan like us. I.e., we have the same attitudes, the same, meaning, we think about them in Shushan the same way we think about Jews in New York or Los Angeles or Johannesburg or South Africa. I.e., they maintain a strong Jewish identity. They maintain, for whatever reason, they won't eat pork, they'll do whatever. And a connection to this idea that there's a Jewish people. I'm wondering if that's true. I'm personally not convinced that that's true. I'm actually convinced that it's not true. Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. Right, which means everybody went. Why did they go? And the reason, so I like to ask the question in this way. The reason I ask is the following. Imagine that, I asked this to the men the other day, and I was like, apparently there are no holidays in South Africa that are national holidays. Like, no national holidays. They said they're banking holidays, but they couldn't think of a national holiday. Not a banking holiday, but a holiday that has national significance.
Yes, Soweto Day.
Soweto Day, great. Okay, so do you still celebrate, Soweto Day? Right.
In Australia as well, there was Australia Day.
Australia Day, good, Australia Day. Terrific.
No one celebrated it.
Good.
Like, Australians don't celebrate. Like, they don't do anything special for it.
They had a Barbie? Yeah,
that's
not a... I'll celebrate Australia Day. No problem.
Yeah, because like, America's a religious...
Yeah. No, I don't. I honored it. I couldn't say I appreciated it, but we didn't have a meal. And the main reason we didn't have a meal, because then it would ruin the Shabbat, it would ruin Friday night for us. It was like too much. You know, you couldn't be serious. Thanksgiving.
Yeah. As someone who was an American, I can't understand
that. For me, that's like really shocking.
Yeah.
Like,
do Thanksgiving here. Yeah.
No, not even.
You were shocked that Americans do Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Orthodox, religious Americans.
Very much. Because Americans never saw, they don't see any contradiction between Thanksgiving and Judaism. Meaning they complement each other. It's a very nice ideal, in a sense.
Yeah, it's about Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I mean, the Rebbeim, our Rebbeim used to always say, oh, every day is Thanksgiving in Judaism. Okay, fine, thank you. Okay, but so let's say Australia Day. Great, you have a barbecue. So imagine that, I don't know, New Zealand invades Australia, okay, and exiles all the Australians to New Zealand and mixes everybody together. Would you still celebrate Australia Day the next year?
No.
Would the Australians celebrate Australia Day? Say, there's a new world order. Would Australia celebrate Australia Day? No.
Not a patriotic country.
What?
Australians are
not a particularly patriotic country. Lovely. Okay.
Okay.
The reason... okay, this wasn't intended to be a bash Australia. Okay. Lahavdil. You have to understand that in the times of Bayit Rishon, Jewish practice and Jewish religion, the idea, there was no such thing as a separation of nationalism and religiosity. It was all intertwined. It was all the same. The thing that we want to get back to was part and parcel of Jewish identity. Pesach was, it wasn't just a religious holiday. It was Jewish, it was the national holiday. Right? It was the day that we celebrated as Jews living in Israel. Here's the question. When the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, remember, there is no real such thing as religious Judaism as rabbinic Judaism. Meaning there were mitzvot, obviously there's a Torah Shabbat Peh. But all the institutions that you think of as central to your idea of religiosity, Shmona Esrei didn't exist yet. Shuls did not exist the way we know them today. The core ideas of religious communities existed less. The entire Jewish existence, especially in Yehuda, focused centered around the Beit HaMikdash. what was left of it for all those years. So when Jewish people were destroyed and exiled into Babel, I ask you the question, did they celebrate Pesach?
Yes.
How? Remember, how was Pesach always celebrated? Yeah. No more Korbanot. There was no Purim, there was no Hanukkah. Right? Did they celebrate, you know, to what degree? Shabbat. Did they keep Shabbat in did they keep kosher in Babel? What? Why, yes. Understand, right, in Shema, the whole point of the Shema, what is, what? Correct. There is no normative rabbinic Judaism. You have to think about it in this way. There's a covenant between God and the Jewish people. When we got exiled and decimated and destroyed, right, would you say, like, how many Jews, lahavdil, and this is not lahavdil, but how many Jews after the Holocaust kept the Torah? Right, so you're thinking, now remember, there was a Holocaust, but in addition to the Holocaust, and there was a literal Holocaust, millions of Jews were killed, slaughtered, and in addition to the Holocaust, keep her quiet, in addition to the Holocaust, that's ours, right, but we have another one egging her on. In addition to the Holocaust, he's doing a great job, Itach, yeah, Itach, a good job. You give her the ball or something, okay? In addition to the Holocaust, not only was there a Holocaust, we were kicked out of our land and the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Meaning the fundamental, the core avenue through which we worshipped God and related to God was destroyed and lost. I ask you, and you have to think about it in this way, to what degree did the Jews hope to return? Even with the prophecy, to what degree was there a sense that, wow, the Jewish people will go on? And I have my doubts. So I suggest to you to consider the following. That when the Jews went to the party of Achashverosh, they went to the party of Achashverosh because they saw no problem with it. And they celebrated because, I mean, 70 years is a long time. It's not the first generation. It's the second or third generation already. Right? You're talking about children whose parents were born in Shushan. What language did they speak? Think about the third generation Jews in America. Without the European rabbis. There's only one Rosh Hashiva left, and his name is?
Mordechai.
There's only one guy left from the old country. How did the people look at the Jews in the old country? You know, without the Jews, remember, like I'm reading now a book about Bernard Revel in America. Without the foundations that these, like I would say, ten individuals, established to reestablish American Orthodoxy, it could very well have gone a totally different way. What?
The whole generation of South African Jews.
So why would we think that Shushan should be any different? You grew up a certain way, you are a Shushanite. And the Jews are invited. And so I personally am rather convinced that this is true. That v'kelim v'kelim shonim, Achashverosh is celebrating a new world order, right? L'havdil, right? The king of England is inviting all the Jews of London to an intermarriage. This is what it would be today. And you can imagine the entire Jewish community going, and the only one who refuses to show up is the chief rabbi. And what are they saying to the chief rabbi? Chief rabbi, we love you. You're great, but no, let's move on. That's right. Yeah, and be incensed with him.
Endangering all of them.
Yeah.
It's going on, and you're endangering all of us with your stupidity.
What do you think happened? When Mordechai, when they all bowed down to Haman, right? We don't have time to go into this. This is like, and this is...
Diana was on the ship.
Right? What's that?
Funeral. Princess Diana was on the ship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
She walked out of Marble Arch, nodded as the procession went past, and then walked back into Shul.
They did. Could you imagine nowadays in Facebook and Twitter, everybody goes except the Jews, except the Orthodox, except the Jews to the celebration of, you know what I'm saying? And okay, Mordechai lo yichru avo lo yishtachaveh. Remember, if Mordechai lo yichru avo lo yishtachaveh, who was yichru avo yishtachaveh? Everybody else, including all the Jews. We listen to the Midrash, Tagar Mishon. Mordechai couldn't sleep that night. He couldn't fall asleep. Why? The whole Beit Yisrael mikanshin v'yatvin kademuyi. All the Jews came to him and said, "Ad garamt lana l'chol bishtahada. You caused this." When Haman came and he declared on the Jews, Mordechai couldn't sleep that night, right? Why? Because all the Jews came to him and said, "It's your fault. You did this to us." V'ein at kamta min kadam Haman reshia v'karav. You wouldn't bow down. Can't you just bow down? Why did you have to make this whole trouble? Mordechai has his answers for them. What does God say to the Jewish people? So this is my take, and you can take it any way you want it. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to the Jewish people, listen, you have to understand, Judaism is not matzo balls and bacon. Judaism is, Jewish food is. I said this the other night, what's Jewish food? Sushi is Jewish food. Why is sushi Jewish food? Because it's kosher. I don't care where it came from. The only Jewish food I care about is, does it adhere to the guidelines that I want the Jewish people to keep to or not? You can have, I don't care, you can make Indian food. Egg isn't the egg. All the spices you want. What? Every Friday? Really? Kol HaKavod, on one condition, that it keeps the conditions of the Torah. And the Jewish people, they forget that. And every time, this is what Purim is all about, and they forget this. And it's scary that we forget it. Because every time the Jewish people forget this completely, the more completely they forget it, the more fundamentally and completely someone comes along and reminds us. And the reminder is never a picnic. It's always Haman HaRasha. And people look at me, I feel like, you know, I don't know. They look at me and they're listening to this, they say, come on, like, you know, you Aliyah people are always like, you know, you're the nuts. Don't they say that? Don't they look at you and say that? Like, you know what I'm saying?
I'm sure they must have your podcast,
they must say that you're... I'm like, I know, I'm a radical, you know, whatever. I'm not a settler yet, but you know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm as radical as you can get. Come on, it's really not so bad, calm down. But, I mean, like, is it not this the story of Megillat Esther? Is not that the story? Like you said, you mentioned it. It's like all the Jews in Germany. Like, come on, whatever. Like, there had to be some rabbis like me. There had to be. Who read the Megillat Esther, read the same thing and said, there had to be. I know that I'm naive, and law later should never be. But the Torah teaches us, if it teaches us anything, we are Am HaNivchar. And as soon as we forget Am HaNivchar, Kadosh Baruch Hu reminds us. And it is not the reminder that we want to get. And I think that we've seen nowadays just how quickly things can move. You only have to look at the news in the past month. How fast things can change. How fast. It can change in an instant. In an instant. With an email. With a Facebook. You know what I'm saying? Just how fast. You can imagine it happened in Megillat Esther in the course of a year. Course of years. Right? Nowadays, all you need is... You need one webcast.
It's scary because... in America like that now.
I don't want to say it. You guys can say it. Because I'm crazy enough as it is. But this is a story, Megillat Esther. All right. Did I figure out enough? Good. Have a good week.